It is so good to see everyone. We're going to be learning today, and we move forward in our Kuzari Shirim, and it's fascinating as we learn the Kuzari, he really breaks his ideas down into arguments. So it could be that you don't have to necessarily know all the previous arguments to appreciate what he's doing each week, and that's what we're going to be doing today. We're going to be appreciating Torah and science, or science and Torah. Actually, perhaps a more effective title would have been the idea of consensus. But we'll get to that in just a second. But before we start, I want to take a moment to thank Elliot and Shandel Horowitz, who are sponsoring our learning today, our shiur today, in the memory of Shandel's father, Rabbi Jacob Rabunowitz, Rav Yaakov ben Shlomo Avigdor, who is an Altamirer, came through from Europe and reestablished over here. And that's just a second ago, actually, Dr. Hieberfeld was mentioning to me their memories of him being the dean in EMC and a teacher, a Baal Machaber Svarim, and Be'ezrat Hashem, his continued influence, Be'ezrat Hashem, should continue.
Yamin Yaakov,
Rabinowitz, Be'ezrat Hashem, his memory should be a blessing. Isn't that amazing? All the connections, the Tanakh teaching, Torah teaching. Now, Michael, remember who he is. So, anyways, good memories, a wonderful, wonderful person. We're going to start our learning today as connecting to the tradition, very much so. So here we go. We're going to start off with a very basic observation made by the Kuzari, and then we're going to try to unpack it a little bit. So it starts off with a question that the king of the Khazars asks his dialogue partner, and says in paragraph Memdalet, Gam ze tema im yesh etzlachem minyan barur mibriyas ha'olam. Do you really have a fixed number from creation till today? Meaning, what's your count? Numbers and age is going to be a very significant part of the debate, because the longer it is, the more extensive it is, the less easy you can claim a tradition. The shorter, the more quantified it is, the easier it is to say there is a framework or tradition. Just to understand what's at stake in this. This is not a question of, you know, just what number I put on my calendar. It's a question really about understanding the parameters in which tradition operates. So the chaver, the rabbi responds, Boy on the money ve'ena boy ve'ena yurim ba'zemach loikes mehoidu va'ad kush. The Jews do not argue from, and he's using obviously a biblical terminology over here, from India to Ethiopia, all the Jews agree with the same number, and that is Omar Kuzri, come on, atzem onim hayom, how long is that? Omar chaver, the chaver explains, Arba'as alafim v'chamesh me'ois, 4,500 years. Just by the way, so just to appreciate the setting, if the year we're learning right now is 5,785, so we're talking about essentially the date that he's talking about, 1,300 years earlier, right? Which makes sense, because 1,300 years earlier from today takes us into the 6th to 7th century, right? Common era, which is when the story of the Khazars is emanating. I mean, the whole episode of the Khazars is around the year 700. That's in between the Muslim and the Christian rule in Europe. And the Rav Yehuda Levi living already 300 years later is reflecting on the story of the Khazars, right? So just understand the times. He says, Uperatom mevo'ar mimois adam v'sheis v'enosh ad noach. So you can figure out the amount of years from Adam to Moshe pretty easily, because the Torah gives you those numbers, right? It tells you how old were they when they had their children. It's not such complicated science. And you know, we saw that some of the children sort of left the derech. The Abrahamic derech, einam doimim lo avoyez zolay izbarer v'loim anyan ha'alokiyah. They did not, the light did not switch on the godly idea. V'nim lo ha'animinyan ha'ele ha'alokiyim v'yuchidim v'lo rabim. And so we count our count based on this line, meaning technically speaking, if all these folks had lots of kids, then it becomes complicated. Which line of kids are you counting from? So the line of kids we're counting from is the ones who the electricity connected through, meaning the ones who adopted the ideas of their parents are the ones we follow, and we use their life as a timeline as to how to when we get to Sinai. Until it came to the point where Yaakov had all his children in the fold. Then God spoke to the sum total, and this was now part of included in Israel. Anachnu kibalnu minyan shnei hakadmonim miMoshe v'neida mashiyesh miMoshe v'ata. So Moshe Rabbeinu told us this tradition of how long it was, and we have the tradition from then till now as to how long it took. So he's trying to point out, meaning the first section of time was from when? Was from creation to Moses. Where do we know that from? All those who had godly tradition, right? Son after son after son after son, until Moses. Moses now tells us this, so we have this for a fact, and we can count from Moses, because Moses is pretty relevant, recent history considering, right? 3,338 years. So, and Moses told us 2,448 before that, and that's how we have our accounts. So, the Kuzari asks the question. He says, "Zeh prat marchik ma machshava." He says, now, by the way, sometimes the Khazar is going to be disagreeable, and sometimes he's agreeable. He'll be the yes man. Right now, as being the yes man, he's going to say, you know, it makes sense. The number that you're telling me makes sense. Why? Ki davar kaze iyashar shiaskimo lav asara mibili shiz balbulu v'yigalu sod haskamosam oy yidchu divrei mi shiyirtze levar et som davar kaze. Kol shiket amonim rabim.
So he says, the
Khazar says like this. Imagine you had a committee who was in charge of fabricating our history, right? So let's say there's a group of very charismatic folks who are trying to convince us of the age of the universe, right? So they're going to say, well, you know, let's create a myth which involves, you know, X number of years that we're involved, right? So that's what, you know, Joe, who's the chair of the committee, is going to say. And Fred, who's sitting on the other side of the table, is going to say, "Listen, Joe, that's a little long, right? Why don't we just make it a little shorter, right? Let's say Abraham lived X minus 30 years, you know, and then you know on the other side of the table is going to be Jaime, and Jaime's saying, listen, guys, you're making it too complicated. Let's do it like in tens, right? So like Abraham, you know, lived 50 years, meaning you're never going to get 10 people to agree on the same timeline if you're inventing it, right? So like the fact that there's a national consensus." Is something which indicates that it's not something which was fabricated or something which was, right? Otherwise, nobody, like, we're talking about Jews here. You know, Rabbi Jonathan Sacks actually points out, he says, you know, the anti-Semites, they say that, you know, the Jews, they control the banks, and they control the economy, and they control the weather. He says, little do they know, he says, they can't even control a shul board meeting, you know? It's like, and now you want them to invent history? You want them to tell them, it doesn't make sense. So then says the chaver, you're right. Avraham Avinu atzmo in paragraph mem test haya bador haflaga v'nisharhu ukrava b'lashon eiver avi aviv v'lazenikra ivri. So Avraham was one of the survivors of the Palaga episode, the dispersion generation, and he was. He was a descendant of a fellow called Aver. Aver was the grandson of Noah, right, of Noach. And that's why Avram was called Ivri, because Ivri is from the language of Aver, right? So Hebrew, the translation of Ivri is Hebrew today. So Abraham is called Abraham the Hebrew, because he was a direct, a very close descendant of Aver, right? And it's really technically 10 generations from Noach to Avram, but we relate him directly to the Aver person. So Moshe Rabbeinu appeared only 400 years after Abraham. That's not such a long period of time. And there was lots of awareness of the heavens and the earth. Moses comes to Pharaoh. At this point in time, not everybody believes that God spoke to human beings. Ad sheshmiam dvarim, dvarav ba'aseres advarim. Until God explicitly spoke to humanity and told them the Ten Commandments. Kainoyu amoyimoy, v'loy misichlusam aval mechachmosam, mirasam mitachbulos hachachmos hashmemiyos, v'zulosam asher lo yamdu lamechkar. Mibnei shem kumoy advar hamezuyaf. So even the Hebrews, even the Israelites, didn't believe fully in Moses and what he was saying until they themselves experienced it, and the rest of the world alike. Because they were concerned about, because of their wisdom, they were saying, you know, there could have been other voices, and it could have been other gods, and it could have been other powers that were projecting these ideas.
Ve'eich hayu lashon ever levada veniflaga bavavel bivnei peleg veyachas umakakach lakach el shem umakach lakach el cham ve'artzasam kach.
How could it be that Moshe Rabbeinu comes and he's 400 years later and he comes over and he says to the folks, you know, 400 years ago there was this guy called Abraham. And there was this language, and this language associates with this particular province and area in the Middle East. And this language comes from this part of the family. How could he fabricate that kind of language, or that type of history? Could you fabricate a history of a nation, or not just a nation, of world history, and explaining the demographics of all the known nations around you in the Middle East 400 years ago? How is that possible? So the Mechel Kuzar agrees. Ze lo yitachen. Ve'ech yitachen ze. How is it possible? Ve'anachnu motzi'im chomechachmos b'ksav yodei mechabreyem ha'chamesh shumayel shana. We have writings of people 500 years ago. Right? It's very possible that we can see what they were saying then. Right, so it's not simply
possible.
Now, I just want to just dive into this for a second. This is the primary argument of the Kuzari, and this, in fact, is so well known. This idea is that sometimes even people call this the Kuzari principle. This idea. There's different ways of framing this principle, but it's important to appreciate what he's trying to achieve here. And that is like this, is that it's very hard to, it comes back to what we'll call the national consensus of ideas. So we as Jews, who are descendants of the Israelites, who are descendants of the Hebrews, right? Just to understand the trajectory over here, all agree about a certain timeline. We agree that there was a certain, there was creation. We agree that there was revelation at Sinai. We agree that, right, there was Exodus from Egypt. We agree on all these factors. We tell it to our children, right? Our children are probably the only human beings on earth who know about the ancient Egyptian culture, because the Egyptians themselves are no longer the Egyptians, right? But we're still talking that language. So, well, his observation is, it's impossible. There's no other claim of national consensus or national revelation that exists like this elsewhere in the world, right? If you look at the other religions of that were called the daughter religions of Judaism, Christianity and Islam, they were clearly they were based on in what were called personal revelations, right? So, you know, Jesus had his experience, and then Paul came along and had his epiphany, and now he goes off and he codifies this, and he very charismatically pulls together a group of folks who are going to carry on doing this. And Christianity didn't start off so easy. There was a few bumps in the road until Constantine, but nonetheless, it got traction at a certain point. When it came to the Muslims, when Islam was invented later on in the 600s, so then Muhammad goes off and he goes to the desert and he has his dream, and he comes back and he tells the people, and clearly he was a very charismatic fellow, right, because he got lots of people to kill a lot of other folks, right, so it was, he did this very well, but nonetheless, it was all based on the fact that he said, this is what God said to me, okay? So you know, this is the way cults work in general, right? So in a cult, somebody says, you know, that the aliens are going to come and take us in, you know, 54 days, and if we don't do X, Y, and Z, you know, and so people, you know, people are stupid, people are fickle. It is true. People don't, generally speaking, people, you know, just recently, just last week, you know, Kanye West, you know, Mark Shamai, put out a new song. What's his new song? His new song's called Hail Hitler. That's his new song. And it's a group of, you know, folks who's now moved to like sort of tribal Africans, you know, dressed up in tribal, you know, grunting Hail Hitler. It's like, you know, like the guy clearly did not read what, you know, about the 1936, you know, Olympics in which blacks were not allowed to come to Germany, right? He clearly did not read his history. But nonetheless, but, you know, people are like, you know, like people love this. They're like, free speech, it is allowed, it is very authentic, going back to his roots. It's like amazing. People are really stupid, right? It's really amazing. So it really is amazing how incredibly gullible and stupid people can be, right? And today you think, wow, we have the internet and you can, you know, but we're in an era called post-truth where people just don't, you know, objective reality doesn't seem to faze people, right? We're not going to let the facts get in the way of what we're believing, right? So it is possible that people believe really ridiculous things, but that's not what the Kuzari is saying. You see, because that's what people often argue on this principle, and they say and say, well, look, people are gullible, so they can believe all things. The Khazari is pointing out like this, is you can fabricate all kinds of nonsense, and you can even be very charismatic and get other people to believe that nonsense, but it's not possible to tell them their own history. And you can't tell them what happened to their grandparents. That's the point that the Khazari is making, is like this. So let's say a charismatic leader comes along, and he's got a new culture. It's called Judah. It's called Israel. You know, Hebrewism, or he's an Israelite, and he says, "I want to convince everybody." Right? You know, there's a whole group of black Hebrews today. Right? It's like a whole new thing in America, and they think they were the original Hebrews. It's ridiculous. But nonetheless, so they're reinterpreting the Bible. But to say to somebody that, like, look. And he's going into this argument that Moses speaking to people at the times of Abraham, but we can do it later on as well. To say that, listen, something happened to all of you, all of your parents, and all your parents had this experience. So somebody's going to say, like, you know, Granddad didn't say anything about that. You know, he didn't mention anything. It's kind of like the example that sometimes is given is, let's say that somebody comes to you and says, you know, and there's different versions of this argument, but you know, somebody says to you, you know, that, you know, 150 years ago in Chicago there was a day where the sky turned black, and for 3 days there was no light, and you know, and it rained ashes, you know, something like that. You know, so you say, wow, that's interesting. But you say, but I know people in Chicago, so I'm going to call them up. I'm going to call my friends. Do you remember anything? No, you weren't there. Okay, but do you know somebody who's been there for many years? Yeah, I do. Did your parents ever? No, we never heard of any of this. No, nobody's ever mentioned any of this. So it's nice that you say this occurred, but I'm going to look into newspaper clippings. I'm going to ask people who are there. You can't tell me something that happened in a place that happened to us without us having some record of it. Somebody's going to ask that question at some point in time. Right? That's the argument that he's making over here. Now, by the way, there are people say, well, you know, according to some of the academics, they say, well, you know, in Sefer Melachim, where it describes that Yoshiyahu HaMelech finds the Torah, maybe the Torah that was found there was the last book of Deuteronomy. That was when Devarim was invented. That's the sort of academic argument. And at such a point in time, that's when he convinced them of the history of, that's what a lot of the Muslim arguments against Judaism are. Everything was abrogated and arrived at later on. But to say that people invented their own history and nobody has any record of that history, but suddenly now everybody believes in the same history, that's what seems to be impossible, that notion of consensus. That's what the Khazari says. I want to just deepen that argument just one step further. As an example, take a look at page 3. This is where the Torah says it. So the Torah says over here, in Sefer Devarim, in Parshas Devarim, says, Ki sha'alna liyamim rishonim, when you're going to ask for the earlier days, Asher Yulafon Echad, that came before you, Lemina Yamaze Asher Lukim Adam Es Adam, Adam Allah Aretz, Lemixea Shomaim, like Zer Shomaim, Hania Kadavarazer, Hagarola Zer Nishma Kamo. Ask anybody, have you ever heard, it's on page 3, it's Pasuk in Devarim, ask anybody in the entire earth, from one side of the horizon to the other, if you've ever heard of the following, the Torah says, Hanishma Kol Hashama Am. Have you heard of an entire nation hearing God speaking to them and they lived? Right? So now let's just appreciate this. What the Torah is saying is that there is never going to be another claim of national revelation. Now, this is going into the Torah, the part of the Torah talks about of Matan Torah. Has there ever been, and will there ever be? The Torah is saying you will never be able to find another nation that will make the claim of national revelation. Meaning we claim that 3 million plus people listened to God at Sinai. How do we know 3 million? Because we have 600,000 men in that in what we'll call 20 to 60 range. And we have an equal amount of women. So that's now 1.2 million. We assume that there's clearly people older than 60, clearly people younger than 20. There's clearly at least 2 children. We're talking about at least 3 million people who are sitting at the base of Sinai at this point in time. And the Torah says, we heard this and we all have the same tradition. None of us are, right? None of us say, you know, it happened somewhere else in, you know, the Caribbean, right? So there's nobody else has a different version of the story. So the Torah is telling us, the Torah is arguing, you go and interview around the world and see if any other culture has a claim of national revelation. And the answer is no, which is fascinating, because if national revelation is such a fantastic proof, then you'd imagine that other charismatic leaders would have used it, right? Meaning, like, let's do abducto ad absurdum. Let's say that the Torah was, in fact, a cultural cult created by certain tribes that conquered other tribes and sort of forced upon them this, you know, this myth called biblical creation and Sinai, right? So let's say that's what happened. And the folks who are the conquerors were very charismatic, and they're able to convince people of a fabricated history that they, in fact, their great-great-grandparents experienced this, even though they have no record of it. Let's assume that such a thing could be, right? So now, you are writing this book now. Let's say you are the human authors who are now fabricating the mythological history for this people that you're convincing, right? So the last thing you would do is write this sentence, right? Because like this, what do you just say? I have managed to convince people of a history that didn't occur to them and their families, right? And happened to all of them, and they fell for it, hook, line, and sinker, right? I managed to convince them. So you know what? I'm going to tell you, no one else is going to be able to convince anybody else of this kind of thing. That's a wild argument. Just keep quiet about that. Don't mention National Revelation and other people, because I guarantee you there are going to be other charlatans who are going to be equally as talented as you to convince other tribes about their history that happened to them. Meaning, don't make the argument of what you just did if you are the human who convinced people of the history which they didn't experience, right? Right? That's the danger. Meaning, if you wanted to convince your people, just say, like, this is your history. But don't make the claim that go to each side of the horizon and ask about National Revelation, and no one else is going to say it, because you just managed to do it. You managed to convince people of the fabricated history. So, meaning, and you understand this argument deepens what the Khuzari is saying over here. Is you cannot fake consensus, national consensus, in such a way. And the Torah actually points that out. There's no way of faking national consensus about an experience as well. That's the depth of this. And by the way, you're going to hear there's lots of arguments in different ways against this. Right, so like people say, no, the Torah was invented many thousands of years later, and a thousand years, nobody really knows at that point in time. But nonetheless, we still don't have anybody else who's claimed this. You will hear about the fact that there are certain, you know, Native American tribes that claim some forms of national revelation. There are certain tribal, we'll call it, histories. But if you go into each of those histories, it's more complex than like the Aztecs and some of the experiences they talk about. A lot of the times it was still a prophet who spoke to them or a prophetess or some former prophetess that spoke to the people, right? It wasn't necessarily God Almighty that was speaking to all the people in that form of revelation. But it's worthwhile noting just that there are some claims that, oh, wait a second, you know, Miktzei HaShomayim, what about the Native Americans? It's worthwhile examining each of those myths and understanding that it's not what Sinai was, clearly. Okay, it's just to appreciate this. This is the argument that's being made over here. And there's a lot of ink that is even spilled on this particular point about this idea of consensus. Be it as it may, what is fascinating is that wherever you are, whichever Jewish culture you belong to, wherever you go across the world, everybody agrees on this point. Not only does everybody agree on this point, the Christianity itself is built on this point. Meaning all of Christianity rests upon this basic assumption called Sinai. The revelation of Sinai that this happened, right? So, meaning we're not talking about the 15 million Jews, we're talking about the 2 billion Christians, right? So are resting on this basic point, and they diverge greatly there afterwards, right? But this point is part of it. So this story seemed to have worked, right? Nonetheless, let's go a little further. So he gives other examples of national consensus, and here again there's room for debate, but let's appreciate this. So on top of page 2, other examples of this. We're going to do 2 examples, language and the 7-day week. Okay, so let's just look at them quickly. So number 1 is in paragraph Nun Gimel, says, Ha'ato ro'eh shalashanois kudumois ein lahem tchila. He said, the Chaver says, you know that these ancient languages, do they have a starting point? Amar HaKuzari aval hem chadashois muskam aleihem. Morel ze chiburam mina shemois apoalim amilois vehem mina osios alekuchois mimotsoya dibur. So he says, look, the truth is that languages are a certain level of what we'll call it dialect or consensus, which are clear through the way that the sentence structures and their verbs work. So the Chaver says, Ari isa bode lo shon miliboy o shamata olav. Have you heard about anybody who successfully managed to make a language, right? Have you ever heard anybody who suddenly one day says, you know, listen, we're going to start speaking pig Latin, you know? And he gets everybody to like kind of figure, you know, we'll all start from now. Doesn't usually work like that. So the Khuzari says, Loira izi, v'lo shamati, ואין סוף שהגיעו אליה בדור מהדור הזה, לא היסו קודם ללושון, שהסכימו עליה מהסכמה עם ביוצי עם, עם על הלושון. So his, the argument that he's making over here, the way at least I understand this over here is that the Torah tells us that there was a point in time that the world was safa achas udvarim achadim. That's what the Torah tells us in Bereishis Perek Yud Aleph, right? So the Torah tells us that everybody spoke what seems to be the same language, and although there are those who suggest that maybe they did speak different languages because it's Lil Shonam beforehand, nonetheless, it sounds like it's one language. And then we have this episode called the Tower of Babel, and after the Tower of Babel, there was dispersion, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu says that Nevala Sham Sefosam, we're going to, mix up their languages, and from that point in time, their language was dispersed. So the Kuzari seems to be relating to this idea. He's saying that it doesn't make sense that suddenly one day somebody woke up and said, well, let's start speaking this thing called German. And somebody said, let's start speaking this thing called Latin. And somebody said, well, let's start speaking Spanish. It must have been there was a starting point at a point in time, and the Torah is providing this for us. And it makes sense that this all comes, meaning that the dispersion, the divergence of languages came from this point in time. Right? Otherwise, how does this actually work? Now, this argument is open to debate because, meaning, he is right. Nobody's one day opened up a new page and said, let's start a language. What happens is dialects develop. Like, let's look at, as an example, at English for a second, right? So, as Winston Churchill once said, is that America and England are the only two countries divided by a common language, right? If you think about that. But think about how even in 250 years, the languages, now we speak similarly, but there's a lot of differences in terminology, in intonation. There's a lot of differences, and that's just one language. If you go back in languages and you appreciate where Latin comes from, that helps you understand English. You understand the ancient English, you'll be able to understand Germanic English, German, right? The languages do develop, right? There's been a development of languages throughout time. Now, if there is a development, you could argue, like sort of in the evolutionary scale, that there must be a starting point from where it all came, right? There's a certain point. The Torah argues that point was here, in Bereishis Perek Yud Aleph. In history, it is interesting to note that there's a little bit of a debate around this topic as well. So like here's an example in Scientific American, in Source 6. So scientists are aware of more than 7,100 languages in use today. Nearly 40% of them are considered endangered. Right, have you ever heard of endangered languages? We protect endangered species, but do we protect endangered languages? Nonetheless, so 40% of them are endangered, meaning that they have a declining number of speakers and are at risk of dying out. Some languages are spoken by fewer than 1,000 people, while more than half of the world's population uses one of just 23 tongues. Now, as to skipping to the next top, on the next page, as for the oldest language that is still spoken, several contenders emerge. Hebrew and Arabic stand out among such languages for having timelines that linguists can reasonably trace, according to Hebrew, who's a researcher. Although the earliest written evidence of these languages date back only around 3,000 years, Hiber says that both belong to the Afro-Asiatic language family, whose roots trace back 18,000 to 8,000 years BCE, or 20 or 10,000 years ago. Even with this broad time frame, contemporary linguists widely accept Afro-Asiatic as the oldest language family. But the exact point at which Hebrew and Arabic diverge from other Afro-Asiatic languages is heavily disputed. The oldest written language, the article argues, is Sumerian, right? At least that's what we have written. Now, it's very hard to bring proofs from all these things because, meaning it just depends what piece of pottery you found with Ugaritic or Sumerian or Hebrew. So but it's clear the same language, the language family clearly is Hebrew and Arabic. The question is about the written language, the written form, and the written form is one of those languages in that family itself. The argument that he's pointing out over here is that the Torah's description of this sounds pretty cogent in terms of how languages developed, right? Whether it was a specific point or a slow emergence of ideas, but nonetheless, this seems to fit the point. It is worthwhile noting that not every seems to be so limited to this argument. So as an example, when trying to understand why our language is called the holy language, we call it Lashon HaKodesh, why do we call it this? Not everybody agrees on this point. So as an example, the Rambam Memorah of Rochim says, the Li in Saul 7. Gam kein tana vesibu kriyas lo shenenu lo shena kodesh. Lo veloi tachshov shu haflaga mimenu. Oy taus, aval hu emes. The wise of the holy language. Min meshe geze hala shena kodesh. Lo hunach boi shem le kliya meshagel. Veloi le mi, loi min anashim, veloi min anashim. Veloi le guv, ma amase. Hamevi lo alada, veloi shle shesen, veloi le tzar.
He says, this language happens to have no words to describe sexual organs, intimacy, or the body's or the orchestration of the body's expulsion of waste products. Meaning, the language itself is devoid of the words of perhaps more the lower, you know, we'll call the lower level or the more sensitive aspects of the of human nature. So why is it called Lashon HaKodesh? Because it is holy, it is euphemistic, it is censored of those things. That's how the Rambam explains Lashon HaKodesh. The Ramban disagrees, and he says in Source 8, V'yimid b'nei ta'amo shal harav, if it's because of what the Rambam says, ho'yukorin ha'losha nekiya, it shouldn't be called the holy language, it should be called the clean language, right? That's what it should be called. Ki'inyan shishanino, ad sh'yakiv zakan ha'tachtoin v'miloyon, and he goes on, he gives an example. He says, v'chein tametzli, in the second paragraph, b'amesh ha'raboseinu korin loshana torah loshana kodesh, what is it called loshana kodesh? So why is it called Lashon HaKodesh? Because it is the language which God chose to communicate in. Meaning, God chose one language through which is the medium he's going to communicate to human beings. And that was the language of Hebrew, which became holy through that process itself. Okay? Now, just notice, by the way, between the Ramban and the Rambam, it doesn't seem to be that they're arguing that this was the only language. Notice that, right? They're not saying that this was the only language. In fact, according to the Rambam, there were many other languages. It just happens to be this is the cleanest of the languages, according to the Rambam. According to the Rambam, this is the language that God chose to create heavens and earth. It was a language with which God spoke to humanity. But there were other languages as well. So if we're going to carry on reading that in the academic journals, technically speaking, Sumerian appears early on. It doesn't really matter necessarily to the Ramban or the Rambam, yeah, we could have the emergence of other languages, and that's totally fine. But this is the language which is holy because of its usage as well. Just to appreciate this point over here. The Khazari is saying is that look, you can't invent languages. It must have come from some point. The Torah gives us that point, and it matches our reality. Just understand. I don't think we have to be married to the idea that this was the only language. In fact, even before you read Bereshis Perek Yud Aleph about the Dora Palaga, the Dora Flaga, you find that it says Lil Shonam. They speak like different languages. So it seems that there are dialects already here as well.
By Yosef and Paro, it implies there were 70 languages. Malach taught Yosef all the languages and Paro did not.
Yeah, no, but that fits
that's 70,
the,
so that's already.
That fits into things because that you could say it's after Dora Palaga. But the question is beforehand is more complicated. So this is the argument. Now he moves on to the Khazari moves back. We're gonna move back to page 2, to the next argument about consensus. This is a very fascinating argument, which goes as follows. He's trying to point out that there's certain things which we just do, which we just have in our culture, which are based on the fact that the Torah is true, right? So one is that we all speak Lashon HaKodesh. This seems to be the earliest of languages. The fact that everybody agrees about the history of Sinai. But now he goes on to the next one, which is the week. He says in paragraph Nun Zayin, Omar HaChaver, Ashamata al Uma Shecholekes Bashavua Yodua. Do you know another nation that has a different number for the week? Shadchalasai Miyam Rishon Vashlamasa Bashabas that doesn't start on Sunday and ends on a Saturday. Hayitokhen Shiyishu Boze Anshei Atzin Im Anshei Iyei Ma'arav Beli Haskala Vakel Haskama. Is there a nation from the Chinese in the east to the West Indies in the west who are going to disagree with a 7-day week? So the Khazari says, "Lo yitochen ze, ela baskama min hakol." Everybody seems to agree with us. Ze rachok. How could it be? Oishu amedabrim kulam bnei Adam or bnei Noach or zulasam v'yeh shavu etzlam mekubal yavim yavim. It couldn't have been unless there was some sort of tradition that this is how weeks work. That's what I mean. And he goes on to say about the decimal system, which is fascinating. He says, how could it be that we're using base 10? Well, that's the next thing he gets to. But just for a second about the week, which is fascinating, is the week is a problematic system, right? If you think about it, right? Because everything else we can understand exactly why it is. Days, why is there a day?
Cycles.
It's the earth turns into axis. It takes just over 24 hours for the earth to turn on its axis, and so we divide that period of time into 24 sections, and we call that a day, right? That's how we have the day. How do we know there's a month? Because the moon moves around us in 29 and a half days, right? And it isn't the same every month, but we know that there's the lunar cycle. How do we know there's a year? So the solar, when the sun appears in the sky in the same place. Now, technically speaking, we're just appearing in the same spot around the sun. But from our perspective, from an anthropocentric perspective, the sun is in the same place. And we can measure this, right? People are sensitive to this, and they could measure this again and again and again. And you could know that there's a day, a month, and a year. The week has no calling in the heavens necessarily, right? And in fact, there were many different systems. So, for instance, in the Babylonian system, there was a 7-day week, but it started at the beginning of every month. So they restarted the cycle. So, like, again, a month is 29 days, so they'd have 7, 7, 7, 7, so it'd be 28 days. The last week would go a little longer, and then they'd start again. 7, 7, meaning they try to fit the sevens into the week. You know, the Egyptians tried a 10-day week. There was an attempt at a 5-day week at a certain point. None of these attempts actually ever succeeded. Right, the Egyptians had the 10-day week. It's interesting, actually, just more recently in communist Russia, they tried to bring it down to a 5-day week, if I'm not mistaken. That was the attempt, and it was not successful. They moved it back to the 7-day week in the 1940s. The French tried after the French Revolution, creating a 10-day week again. The reason why people didn't like it was because it was 2 years, not enough days off for the people. Can you imagine that? Like, it's like we talk about Monday blues. If you had a 10-day week, like, you know, you'd be dead, right? So it didn't work. So all these were called atheistic cultures. Notice, by the way, who the cultures that try to change it are atheistic cultures, right? French Revolution was a non-religious, was a not a religious revolution, and so was the Russian Revolution. Both of them led to incredible amounts of bloodshed. But they tried to both change the week, and it was not successful. Didn't stick. And what's fascinating about this is that, but nonetheless, the accepted consensus today is 7 days. Why? And the basic reason is because HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, "Oy siu benu benu ben Israel, lo olam." Right? We say this every Shabbos. It is an eternal sign between me and Israel forever that there's going to be 7 days because of creation. Now, it is worthwhile knowing, if you go into the research, and Abby actually mentioned this to me just a little while back when we were discussing this, is that there is an argument as to why there's a 7-day week, which is outside of the realm of the Bible, and that is that there really, technically speaking, there are 7 visible luminaries in the sky to the naked eye, right? So we have the sun and the moon, and then we have 5 planets, right? We have Mercury, Venus. We're forgetting Earth for a second. Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, right? So there are 7 of these planets, and in fact, if you go back into, let's say, Cassius Dio, and he talks about this, and this becomes the Roman calendar. Ultimately, it's related to each of these planets. So, for instance, the names, in fact, are very much connected to this, which is like that on page 6. So, Sunday, of course, is the day of the sun. Monday is the day of the moon. Tuesday relates to the Norse god of war, which relates to Tyre, which is the Mars, the day of war, because remember, the Mars is red, like blood. Wednesday, of course, is the Germanic Mercury. Thursday is Thor, which relates to thunder, the Greek gods of thunder, and that relates to Jupiter. Then there's the Norse goddess of Friday, which is associated with the god of love, that's Venus. And then finally, Saturday is Saturn, right? So each of these relates to the different days of the week, and that's why the names we actually have are as such, which is, by the way, a good reason why we should really use the language of the Torah, which is Yom Rishon, Yom Sheni, because we count towards Shabbos. That's how the Hayom Yom Rishon b'Shabbos Sheboi Hayu Levim Amri v'Beis Midrash, meaning we count towards Saturday. We don't count towards planets and gods, right? That's just understanding our language, is incorrect. But nonetheless, this is how it works. So why do they choose each of these days? So it depends. Actually, the Gemara even talks about the cycle in Brachos. The Gemara talks about is the, let's assume that you have the appearance of the sun at a particular point, right? So how does this work? It starts off like the day that the sun was created is where the Gemara assumes it. But if you look at Cassius Dio, it's sort of looking at a 10-hour cycle where you have first the sun appears and then the moon at a particular point. And if you carry on moving the cycle around, the beginning luminary of each day would be each of these, which is why they do it in this order. Another reason they do this in order is because they don't know necessarily the distance between the planets in those days. What do they know? They just knew the speed of the planets. So they're going in order of the speed of the movement of each of these ideas, right?
How do they know Saturn? How do they see this?
You can see Saturn.
You can see it?
These are all visible to the naked eye. You're not in New York. We've got so much light pollution. But just a few weeks ago, there was an alignment of the seven planets, just at sunrise on Shabbos. And so these are things that people were aware of. They could not see Uranus. Uranus was only discovered 300 years ago. Neptune and Uranus, they were discovered later on with telescopes. But these ones you can actually see and appreciate. But having said this, to me, just in my humble opinion, you know, it's all very nice to say that if you have this sort of system and you can see these charts of sort of if you start the sun here, then the next then 10 hours later is going to be the appearance of the moon, and you can put them onto different days. But at the end of the day, it sounds to me more like you're trying to fit the puzzle pieces into the exactly. The consensus was 7 days. Why is the consensus 7 days? Let's stop apologizing for the fact that the Torah says it. Meaning, we keep on as if the Bible doesn't count. As the Bible doesn't count as any sort of form of proof. So, you know, maybe other people approximate it. No. The Torah says, and that's why it was, and there were fewer Hebrews at the time, until, you know, expanded greatly. But nonetheless, our way of looking at the world has been adopted by others, and it's nice that the planets fit into that. But that happens to be a later day. We'll call it a Roman invention or a Roman application, as opposed to saying it. It's funny, there was an article in The Economist which was sort of trying to, you know, take away the fact that this is biblical. But like somebody pointed out, but The Economist says, you know, deliver every 7 days too. You know, meaning we're all still working with the same basic operating principle. So that this is the Kuzari, again, another example of consensus. Now, I'm not going to do this. I'm going to skip over this because I want to end with one last argument, which I think is fascinating. The Kuzari now asks him. He says, "Wait a second." He says, "But you're claiming the king of the Khazar says you're claiming there's consensus on all these things." He says, "Let's go back to timing or the age of the universe, because you're assuming that, you know, from Moses to back to Abraham was 400 years, and the age of the universe is such." He says, "But like in Indian culture, they assume that they claim that they have certain buildings which are 10,000 years old, right? So they claim that they have an older culture. That's what he argues." So the Melach Kuzari is not so worried about this, and he points out that, look, the Indians themselves are a backward culture. They don't have so much writing, and they themselves can't agree on certain things. They say this about many religions, that they have all these ancient buildings, and that's to undermine the various other religions. But, you know, they themselves don't have any form of consensus about their claim itself. And so he was not so concerned about this as well. And again, you know, it is interesting to go back into Sanskrit and sort of look at the fascinating history and how history operated. If you saw reading, there's a book called Zachor by Dr. Yerushalmi on the notion of history. It's very fascinating to understand how the history in this particular domain of the world was actually not a relevant topic. It's very, very, very fascinating as to. So he dismisses this, but the more complicated question he asks is not about a pagan culture claiming an older universe. Is philosophy? Philosophy in those days means physicists, right? Meaning to say people who they didn't have the tools to measure the universe, but they thought about it. So he says, what about them? So the greatest argument he has is in paragraph 7 Beis. Amar Kuzari, Emor say, ki ta'anti alecha bu'uma mufkeres uva'om she'enu maskimim odasecha. So you dismissed a nation which isn't tethered, isn't anchored. And I agree with your answer. Umatoma bephilosophiem. Right now, science has agreed, and this is the basic assumption of science, is that not that the world is very old, but the world always was. This is constant state universe, right? So the world always was in existence. That's what you're arguing, right? So how can you argue with them? So you can dismiss the Indian culture and say that they're backwards and they're pagan and they don't agree and their history is not coherent. But what are you going to say about the philosophers who worked this out logically, that there is no beginning to the world? That's his argument. So argues the Kuzari in paragraph Samak Gimel. He says, "Our philosophim ein la hashim oisam." He says, you can't blame those philosophers. They just don't have a tradition. This is such a fascinating observation. Don't blame them for their misunderstanding. They don't have a tradition. Meaning, and he goes on to say that Aristotle was a very, very, very wise person, but he simply was lacking a tradition. Now, it almost seems like oxymoronic what he's saying, right? Meaning, that's the point. Aristotle will get up and say, exactly, that's the point. I don't want a tradition. I've thrown away all the Baba Mises, and I've now sat here on my philosopher's stone, and I've figured it all out now based on what I can see and experience and measure, right? That's the point. I don't want to have to rely on all this nonsense, right? So what does he mean by this? So I think it comes down to a very fascinating point. Like, you know, if you read, I put it in here for his edification, but you can read Aristotle, you know, as an example. So like on page 7, I put in, this is in Aristotle, where he talks about the fact that he argues that not only is time eternal, but he argues that motion is eternal as well. The argument by which he comes to this, right? It doesn't make sense that there's any starting point. It's always, there always was motion, there always was time. That's what Aristotle argues, right? And this is where he argues it. It's a much longer section. I just put in the most salient point over here. Right, he says, how can there be any before and after without the existence of time? And he goes on to describe that time must be eternal. There's no point from which it started. There's no point which motion started. Everything was in constant state. This is what Aristotle argues. To me, it's fascinating because there's lots of reasons why to disagree with this. The Rambam would disagree with him on a logical level. So the Rambam in Moreh Nevuchim spends an extensive amount of time trying to disprove Aristotle. Why? Because the Rambam, by the way, is educated by the greatest of philosophy and physics at the time, and he was very well versed in Aristotelian ideas. In fact, much of the Rambam's science is based on Aristotelian philosophy, right? That's some of the claims that some of the Vilna Gaon had on the Rambam, was that the Rambam was in fact too versed in Aristotelian ideas and philosophy and ideas. But nonetheless, the Rambam tries to argue in a logical way against Aristotle. So when the Rambam disagrees with the man, look at the example he gives as a mashal in Moreh Nevuchim. This is a translation. He says, let's say you had a man is born without defect. A man born without defect had after his birth been nursed by his mother only for a few months. The mother then died, and the father alone brought him up on a lonely island until he grew up, became wise, and acquired knowledge. Suppose the man never had seen a woman or a female being. He asked some person how man came into existence and how he had developed, and receives the following answer. Man begins his existence in the womb of an individual of his own class, namely in the womb of a female, which has a certain form. While in the womb, he is very small, he has life, moves, and receives nourishment, and gradually grows till he arrives at a certain stage of development. He then leaves the womb and continues to grow till he is in the condition in which you see him. The orphan will naturally ask, did this person, when he lived, move, grow in the womb, eat and drink and breathe with his mouth and his nostrils? Did he create any substance? The answer is no. Undoubtedly, he will then attempt to refute the statements of the person and to prove their impossibility by referring to the properties of a fully developed person in the following manner. When any one of us is deprived of breath and for a short time he dies and cannot move any longer, how then can we imagine that any of us has been enclosed in a bag in the midst of a body for several months and remained alive, able to move? If any of us would swallow a living bird, the bird would die immediately when it reached the stomach, much more so when it came to the lower part of the belly. If we should not take food or drink with our mouth, in a few days we would undoubtedly be dead. How then can a man remain alive for months without taking food? If any person would take food and would not be able to excrete it, great pains and death would follow in a short time. And yet I am to believe that a man has lived for months without function? Suppose by accident a hole was formed in the belly of a person, it would prove fatal. Nevertheless, we are to believe that the navel of the fetus has been open. Why should the fetus not open his eyes, spread forth his hands, and stretch out his legs, if, as you think, the limbs are whole and perfect? This mode of reasoning would lead to the conclusion that man cannot come into existence and develop in the manner described. So the point is like this, is if all you're working with is what you experience, right, then there's going to be lots of questions. Right? I mean, this man never saw a female. He never understood the process of gestation. He never understood what a fetus looks like. So of course he's not going to believe that process because he doesn't have access to that. So that's a very short-sighted way of looking at things. Meaning, Aristotle, you can't imagine there's a point at which the time began. Right? I understand you're working with the apparatus that you have, so you're going to come to a certain conclusion. This is the Rambam's argument in logic. The Khuzari is not even arguing in logic. The Khuzari is coming from a very experiential point. He's saying that Aristotle was not endowed with tradition, and therefore he made bad decisions. Just to understand what this means, I would like to deepen what the Khuzari means, and we'll close with this. Is that there's an essay written by Rav Eliyahu Dessler in Michtam Eliyahu, in the first section, called Mabat HaMS. It's a really, really fascinating essay. And he makes the argument that in the end of the day, Every decision that we make about the world around us is still a decision. There's no objective reality in the sense of, you know, there's a objective imposition upon us that we have to all believe because it is so clear. Even that itself is a decision as well. So, for instance, the Rav Dessler goes into the description about, let's say, like, I'll give you an example of evolution for a second, and don't call me in this way because I've spent hours and hours and hours on evolution. But as an example, we know there's evolution, right? We know there's evolution, right? We can see it in labs. We can see that bacteria evolve. We know that bacteria evolve. We can see that finches have evolved in different islands, right? Even to the point that they can't mate with each other. We know that. We can prove that, right? But does that mean to say that species turned into different species? We have no proof of that. That's called macroevolution, right? But I can choose to say that that must be the mechanism which led to everything else, or I can choose not to, that maybe the fossil record was born into the earth. I can make a decision. Those are decisions I have to make. And those decisions are informed by tradition. You understand? Meaning I'm still making a decision about the process of which I look at the world. As an example, the statistic probability of the arrival of life is next to nil. The fact that inorganic life can emerge, that a number of amino acids can line up to create a protein, which is the basic full carrier of life, is practically nil. It's almost completely impossible. But so what does science say? Well, science says, well, if we have the age of the universe is 15 billion years, then almost the impossible is going to happen at a certain point in time, right? So they say, well, there is proof that there was a big bang, right? There was the world was created. So they say, and the windows of possibility of the world being created, of the Big Bang, there being enough gravity and not enough gravity, clumpiness, not clumpiness, all these variants are a window that's so infinitesimally small that the possibility of the world coming to being is almost next to nil. So what does science argue? Well, yes, there were a multiverse, right? Meaning there must have been many, many other failed explosions that did not coalesce into universe, and this is the only one of the millions and billions that actually did. Which means that every time I encounter a question about the way that things work, I have the choice to make as to whether the almost impossible can happen or doesn't happen. Was it guided? Was it not guided? Was it possibility or probability that was more time, more space, more other bangs that occurred that didn't? I'm still making a decision. Rav Dessler's argument is that even a person who claims objectivity is still making a subjective decision based on the type of lifestyle they would like to lead. And therefore, I'll give an example. Rashi brings this. At the beginning, it says at the beginning of the Dora Palaga, it says that there was Safachas Dvarim Achadim, right? So what does that mean? Rashi brings a number of explanations. Rashi says one explanation is that the human being says once every 1,500, I think it's 65 years, the heavens fall upon our heads, and therefore we should build a tower. What does he mean? What he means is like this. There was this great flood. Everybody knew about the great flood because everybody had been killed, and there was only one family which survived. So now how do you theologically deal with that? So the problem is like this, is that the theological implications of that flood is really bad for my lifestyle because it's very claustrophobic because I know the reason that happened was bestiality and thievery and womanization, all these kinds of things that were going on at those times, right? So if all those acting out led to an annihilation of humankind, so therefore that makes certain theological moral demands upon me, correct? So now I have to behave in a certain way. I don't like the implications of that. So I'm going to create a theory in which every 1,500 years or so, the sky falls on a head, meaning this is just a cycle, right? This is the kind of thing that happens, right? So if I can create such an explanation, which is a choice, then I have now unhitched myself from the moral responsibility of what happened then. That's what people are saying. That's the tragedy of the whole experience of the Dora Palaga, which is why God has got involved, according to that line in Rashi. That's the same thing, is we always are making a decision. And the decision underpinning of that decision is often an emotional lifestyle that we want to lead. That's the argument that Odessa makes. Every human being is biased towards the answer and the type of lifestyle they want to lead, and I'll make arguments to get to that point. That's how it works. So just when it comes to Aristotle, as an example, the predominant view in science In those days, was the world had no starting point. The world was Olam Kadmon. It always existed. Bereshis Bara, that's nonsense. That's those mythological Jews who go about creation epics, the backwards, tribal, uneducated, unschooled, unlettered, innumerate people who just believe in anything. That's what the was in those days. Greek culture, Arabic culture, which adopted Greek culture and the sciences, was against us. The Rambam stood on this little island trying to defend it itself. Well, you know what the dramatic irony is? Is that it took science all this time to catch up, because in the 1920s they said, you know what, it must be that if there was a starting point for the world, there must have been a radiation which was in the background, which indicated that there was this expansion process, right? Fair? So they said, if we could find this background radiation, then we'd be able to prove that in fact there was this expansion point from point zero in which the world was created. And guess what? In the 1960s, they found that. In 1960s, at the Bell Lab Laboratories in New Jersey, they discovered that there was a background radiation. They thought it was radio interference, they thought it was white noise, they thought it was the pigeons, and they killed the pigeons after a while, and they found out that this was a very sensitive satellite, that there was a background radiation, which proved the theory of the Big Bang, which means to say that now, in the scientific community, except for a few crazies, that generally speaking, everybody accepts that there was a starting point to the world, which means that science itself arrived at the conclusion. But what does it come down to the Khuzari? Is you don't have to blame Aristotle. He didn't have a tradition. Meaning, it's not child's play. It's not saying, okay, you know, what he's saying is that if you don't have a tradition, you can make up all kinds of things based on your logic. Based on the Rambam saying, is your logic is limited, or based on the fact that you just aren't anchored in anything which is leading to a serious conclusion. That's his observation over here. Many, you can disagree with this idea, but this is a very profound perspective in looking at appreciating the decisions made within the scientific community. Have a wonderful